I'm really pleased to welcome Jackie Rowe. Jackie has published four pamphlets to date, Blue, Apollinaire, Paint and Ransom. And Blink is her first full collection. But what I really enjoyed was reading David Clark's blog, and he says that this collection should actually be called A New and Selected, which I think is absolutely right, because it's a real body of work that's and I think a lot of people would agree that, you know, it was kind of came as a surprise that this was actually a first collection, you know, so that's how I felt too. And the collection is published by V Press, who are a newish press, I think, aren't they?
Yes, I actually launched the press with my pamphlet Ransom Notes. It was their first single author pamphlet, and that was 3 years ago. So, but they've done really well. They had a Saboteur Award winner for best pamphlet, and another one nominated. And they had Anthony Owen's Nagasaki Elder book was shortlisted for the Ted Hughes. So they've done very, very well in 3 years. Yeah. I haven't won anything at all with mine, but I'm just having a reflective glory, basically.
That's great, though, and I think it's definitely an energetic press and relatively local to us as well. I think based in Worcester.
Well, Sarah's based in Droitwich. I'm not sure where Ruth's based, but they're around Worcester, Droitwich.
So it's really lovely that this exciting press is also in our region. So that is really good to note. Jackie is prominent on the literary scene, in particular for her work as co-editor of Flarestack Press, which has run for a really long time.
No, actually, but it's coming up to, it's 9 years this year. It seems longer. Actually, it seems much longer. It's 9 years this year that we first published.
Yeah. Right, and Flarestack also has a very good pamphlet competition.
Well, we have open submissions.
But we're
not at the moment because we took on a lot from our last open submissions, and we've got a bit of a backlog now, including taking on a couple of things as we went along, including, which is coming very soon, a new pamphlet from Salima Hill.
Oh, right.
Which she sort of submitted to us out of submission, which I wouldn't tell anybody else to do, but obviously it was Salima Hill, so you don't tell about the rules.
Yes, so that's great. And also as a workshop leader, and through residencies is happening at the Barber Institute for Fine Arts, which I don't know if people are aware of. We were wondering that earlier, because it's one of the best places to go to from Ledbury, because it's at university.
Absolutely, you just get the train from Ledbury to university and you just walk across the campus, which isn't the easiest thing to do at the moment because there's a lot of work going there, but yeah, it's just to walk across the campus, and the Barber is an amazing gallery. It's regarded as being one of the best small galleries in Europe, actually. Yeah. It's got paintings of the quality of the National Gallery. So it's an incredible gallery. Yeah.
It is. I mean, when I found it, I couldn't believe it. I wouldn't even necessarily call it small, because it seems so grand and imposing.
It's a lovely building.
And I've attended Jackie's workshops myself, and I would describe them as imaginative, very attentive and generous in the way you do the workshop. So I think that describes Jackie Rowe very well, both as a poet and a champion for poetry. So please join me to welcome Jackie Rowe.
I am going to stand up. I feel I could possibly sit down because it's such a small space, but I will stand up, make it seem beneficial. This is my copy of Blink. You wouldn't believe that I only got this last October, actually, but I just carry it in my bag because you never know when someone's going to ask you to read something. And it's more impressive to get this out of my iPad. So it's not a sign of how many readings I've had. It just seems really, really battered from being in my handbag for the last 6 months or so. Chloe's absolutely right, and David Clark was absolutely right. I did see this as being a new and selected. There is new work in it, and some work I very much wanted to get published that had come out of residences and things like that. But also, if you have pamphlets, they don't generally last very long, and so there was things out of my four pamphlets that I wanted to bring back and to put into a kind of context with each other, with newer work. And some stuff that had been published in magazines, which is also quite ephemeral. So this does actually span, in fact, the oldest poem, which is the last poem we're going to read, I've worked out is at least 18 years old, so it does actually span a long time, this book. But the whole theme of it is actually time, which I'm fascinated by. And everything I write has an element of time in it. And I'm writing fiction, actually, which is about time and about time travel and things like that. And so for that reason, I said to Ruth Stacey, who designed the cover, that I wanted the cover to have a broken watch on it. Now, people think this is a gun. It's not a gun. It's actually a broken watch. You can see the numbers around. She'd actually break a watch and took the photograph. And that. So the first poem in the book, I think, sets the theme. It's called Life in a Day. And I didn't look at my watch. Our day was daffodils. I opened my eyes in equinoctial dawn, shaped by winds and clouds, saw buds crack that would be fruit for our descendants. No gloom until an evening star told me I was ageing. Night-born, sun-starved, he who was forged in darkness, swaddled himself in blindness to sleep, sometimes woke frozen in memories of the sickle moon. Yellow afternoon we met and wed. He showed me chronicles of the asparagus years, epochs of oysters, powdery engravings of ancient snow, and something he called roses. And Chloe mentioned the barber. Where, yeah, I was in residence at the barber actually 5 years ago. I started there in 2013. And the official residency lasted a year. Though I wasn't there all the time. I mean, people think if you're in residence somewhere, they actually think I kind of live there. But actually, no. I mean, it was. I had to earn my living elsewhere as well, because it was only a certain part of my income that came out of being in residence at the barber. But what I wanted to do was to set up a creative writing programme, which I did straight away. In fact, I started doing creative writing workshops there straight away, and it's still running. There's one this coming Saturday, in fact. So I do monthly workshops there. A lot of them in response to temporary exhibitions that last for about 3 months. And because I have to plan so far in advance, I often haven't seen the exhibition by the time I write the blurb for it. So often when I actually see the exhibition, it doesn't fit in with what I thought I was going to do, which could be the case for this coming Saturday, actually. In the first year I was there, I did write a lot about works in the permanent collection. And so I'll read. There's a sequence at the centre, which is the works from the barber, and I'll read a few, three of those. This is for a Degas statue, a small Degas statuette called The Grand Arabesque Third Time. Obviously, that's not what Degas called it, but for some reason the titles are always translated to English at the barber. Which is actually a maquette that Degas had left when he died. It wasn't actually cast until several years after he died, and you can see some of it was. I think it was made in wax, and you can see some sort of impurities, like where there's been little bits of damage in the meantime. Malleable as wax, a dancer's body, bent in different planes, a windmill, leaves of grass, a saltier, swift. Or is she bowling, skating? Animated in the pages of a flicker book. He left her mutable, as unfixed as the third beat of an arabesque, the pose ephemeral, on her the grasp of bronze like mercury. And this is for a portrait called Young Woman Seated by Renoir. Actually, the sitter's name is Nina Lopez. Which is you can actually find these on the Barber website, so you can look them up later. I did try to do a bit of a visual display, but I couldn't get them to come up in any size. You could see them on my iPad, basically. But this is a blonde young woman, and actually it reminds me very much of Laura Palmer from Twin Peaks, if anybody knows Twin Peaks, which is one of my obsessions. So this painting always makes me think of that. She knows she's a film. Her hair is spun from chintz. She's fading into cushions, grows out of upholstery, where someone has spilt paint like flowers. Monsieur Renoir, is he still here? Her hands are jelly, fingers melting into lips, blue, seen through a pool. Her face brightens from the softness of deep water. Was it he who brought the rose? Waking is long, long-drawn waking to the insight of the house. Thoughts scratching at the path, practice on a distant violin. Piano chords ill-formed and incidental. Music of a car that fails to start. Trees falling to the snow. Crackle on the line. On the ridge, a motorcycle grinds. Outside of her, the future. And this is the poem that gives the collection its name. They're all untitled in this sequence, but this was originally called Blink. And this is for a painting called An Allegorical Tomb of the First Duke of Devonshire. which I love this painting. I've always loved this painting. It's obviously it's early 18th century, and it's by two Italian painters, brothers, who were both called obviously the same name, Ricci and Ricci. But it was part of a kind of money-making scheme, well, you could call it a scam actually, by an entrepreneur, an Irish entrepreneur, who kind of had these allegorical tombs painted by various different painters with a view to selling the paintings, but also to doing engravings from them, which were then kind of sold as the supposed tombs of Whig politicians who weren't yet dead, actually. And it was kind of that Whig supporters would buy these and display them, you know, like we would buy souvenirs now. There are quite a lot of them around, but this is the one I know well. And it's a fascinating painting. It's much better than actually you'd think from that, you know, from the way it was, from its origins. The tomb itself, which is painted obviously in grey, is very dynamic with the figures on it, which are kind of allegorical figures, appearing as if they're coming to life. And it's surrounded by what seem to be real people representing all walks of life, but they're in very sort of static poses, so it appears that the real people are turning into statues. So you have, it's almost like a very early surrealist painting. And I also, to bring in a little bit of popular culture, noticed that one of the angels looked like the weeping angels out of Doctor Who. This is why this poem was originally called Blink. Look, don't look, 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 don't look, don't stop, don't gaze, don't close your eyes. Don't turn your glance from the glass, don't primp your anguished hair, don't stare, don't stop. To reflect that your name and your time aren't there in the vacant cartouche. Don't peer head first down that hole the worms have gnawed. Avoid in the void like snakes in the grass, despair. Unclasp the box, make soup from stone, stir pigment into flesh. And pause, don't pause. Be prey to claws of angels turned grizzled, visé, grey. Stay, don't stay, don't play. Quick to extinct and flick it back. Blink, don't think. Think, don't blink. We actually got the title. I had originally, the working title was Life in a Day, but I do like one-word titles, actually. And I actually got the title with. I lead a poetry group seminar, a poetry school seminar group in Birmingham. And one night, actually in quite bad weather, when not everybody turned up, I went through a lot of the lines from the poems I liked and asked them what they thought of them as titles. And eventually, it was almost a throwaway. I said, "Oh, I could call it Blink." And yeah, Blink. That's right. That's what you should call it. So that's what we did. That's what I did in the end. This is from. I did a pamphlet. Of versions, I'd call them versions rather than translations, of poems by Guillaume Apollinaire, of poems from the First World War. We tend to know earlier poems by Apollinaire in this country, but when my daughter was doing a year abroad when she was at university in the Pyrenees, I bought a lot of French poetry books and I got one of Apollinaire, and there were these poems which I'd never seen before, and they absolutely amazed me because He mixed with Cubist painters, and he wrote in that he was trying to make a poetic aesthetic that was the same as Cubism, that sort of showed things in different directions and maybe didn't always have any logic to it. And that's how he wrote about the First World War. It's the anniversary of his death, actually, 2 days before it's the anniversary of the end of the First World War, because he died of Spanish, of Spanish flu on the 9th of November 1918. So it's coming up to the centenary of his death this year. And this, I think, is one of the most amazing war poems in the original French. I hope my English does it justice, but I think this is one of the most amazing war poems ever written. The pamphlet it came from was called Apollinaire, because that's what my editors at Perdica Press wanted, because that was what they always titled them after the author. I wanted to call it Wonders of War, which is the translation of this title, which is Merveilles de la Guerre. How lovely they are, signalling dark peaks of coryphée, eyes, arms, hearts, daily apotheosis of your comet hair, guilt on these guilt dancers, whose belonging is to bear young with their moments to die. How lovely these rockets alphabetic inscribe life entire and relative. Departing, I see them offer, conceal selves, moving fingers over fire juggling festival. Earth hungry opens long pale mouth. How aroma of toasted skin becomes not disagreeable. If sky ate with land there, it would only in not nourishing swallow souls. But I have run with sweetness how this war all guts length from me has flames crying that I am here. Have ploughed the beds I pour myself in thousand little rivers at prayer of trench. I am still on all sides. I am one beginning this thing for epochs longer than flight of Icarus. I bequeath this story of Guillaume Apollinaire, who handled war and knew himself everywhere contented in towns, behind in all remains of universes, in one barbed and trampled, in women, cannon, horse. Certain it was lovelier, if I could suppose all things I am part of might occupy me, but nothing can, in sense. I am over all, only am in me, me. And then another one about the First World War that came from, this was actually the title poem of a pamphlet called Paint, which Flairstack published, in fact, because I did it in a hurry for, I was involved in a project where contemporary artists, and I was the one writer, responded to Whittock Manor, which is a National Trust property near Wolverhampton. That was owned by the Mander family, who are paint manufacturers. So I called it Paint because there were lots of paintings. The Mander factory were paint manufacturers, and one of the Manders married a woman whose surname was Paint. So the pamphlet's called Paint. But this is actually this poem is actually in response to the war memorial in the garden, which is to the workers from the paint factory who died in the First World War. Paint. Still turns the mill that churns strange earths to mud, emulsifies distemper in the season's shades of battleship, gunmetal, blackened weeds. Elsewhere, hands compile new charts of unexpected pigment, l'horizon bleu, feldgrau, red fleck on snowy breast, shells bursting as mimosa. And I did steal that last line from Apollinaire, actually. That's his image about shells bursting in the scarlet mimosa. But slightly lighter. Another one about colour. This is called Rosé. He calls her Rosé, this blossom and these tulips much with Zinfandel. Discarded woman's blushing scarf. A spattering of dregs on pink girls' coats. Her meniscus lips slicked on the glassy pool, sweet, such sweet, afterthroat of off-dry fruit, us for red and she for ice. It's not that light, actually. Why that's lighter is that because I was in a cafe in Cannon Hill Park in Birmingham, and I heard somebody calling their child, and they were calling a man calling his child, he was calling Rosa, and I thought, that's a great name. And immediately I got the idea of a poem. And then he called her again, and I realised he was calling Rosie with the Birmingham accent. So I got the poem. Okay. Yeah, I will end with a couple more art history ones very quickly. Well, they're not that quick. This one is when I went to my interview, when I was first applied to go to the Barber as writer in residence. I knew the gallery really well, but I went to visit. And on loan from the National Gallery was a portrait of Hendrika Sterfels, who was Rembrandt's mistress, and he painted her quite a lot. And honestly, Rembrandt had passed me by until that moment. I really hadn't taken in much of Rembrandt. But the Barber, and this is one of the reasons why it's a really wonderful place to visit, hangs paintings at eye level. Now, a lot of galleries hang them slightly up so you look at them with reverence, but the Barber hangs them so you look at portraits in the eye, basically. And I was entranced by this portrait of this woman, and I thought I really wanted her to be my friend. You know, it was so human in a way that I'd never expected. She was Rembrandt's mistress, but she was basically his common-law wife. He wouldn't marry her because he reckoned that his first wife, Saskia, had stipulated in his will that she shouldn't remarry. I don't think that's actually true. I'm sure that's never been law. Mm-hmm. But he was a bit of a snob, and Hendrika was the servant. However, when they had a child together, and when he was close to bankruptcy, possibly because nobody wanted lots of self-portraits of a person with a funny hat, but they needed to diversify a bit. But when he was close to bankruptcy, she actually set up an art dealership herself and sold his paintings and saved them. But he still didn't marry her. And at the time, I was interested in constraints, particularly in Alipo constraints, which I won't talk about now, but if you want to ask me about that, you can a bit. And so each of these four sections has got a different constraint. So this is called Four Constraints of Hendrika Sterfels. Look me up on Wikipedia. Find this portrait by Van Rijn, first thing you see. I came from Bredevoort, says the article. My father, known as Jaeger, huntsman at the castle, died when the tower exploded. Three brothers, a sister who married a soldier. Rembrandt never married me, blamed it on Saskia, though she was dead. I confessed in church to whoring with an artist. 2. Dear heart, this hearth thine as I am moved, to thee this bed, this babe, no hand, no bride, abide, be mine. 3. He responds to the challenge of depicting closeness, leaves the painting unresolved, allows her skin to contrast creamy with the pelt that woolly drapes her shoulders, sags, bears the amber at her throat. As he, struggling with relationships, ponders how to represent us in space a woman on a chair. She gazes at us, frank, her look meticulous in execution, hair and jewels less precise. The line he draws between remains ambiguous. 4. I tend our place, look after Cornelia, am drawn, trade in art to keep my man from penury. I'm in envy, even now, of a long-gone woman I may not name. But in love, I remain under common law wife to Rembrandt, painter. And then, when I was appointed, I got taken to see the Prince and Drawing Room, which is not open to the public, though you can actually make an appointment to go and see it, where the Barbara's got about 1,000 works on paper stored in a lot of basically chest of drawers things. The high spot of this was seeing a Rembrandt drawing, which is not on display very often, which is Rembrandt's sketches of people in the marketplace. And this was... A drawing is more immediate than a painting because it's done closer to. So this was like life-changing for me to be this close to. I mean, I loved Rembrandt definitely from that moment on. But without any tissue or anything on it. So my breath was touching what Rembrandt's breath had touched. So I was absolutely entranced by this. And I did have a sort of visceral reaction to want to write about it. But I'd also been thinking, because of something I'd read, about Descartes, who was almost exactly concurrent with Rembrandt. Their lives almost completely overlapped. And it is possible, there are suggestions that Rembrandt was going to... Descartes certainly went to the Netherlands, and Rembrandt was planning to paint Descartes. There's supposed to be a lost drawing somewhere, actually, which is preliminary for it. So that sort of started this poem, basically. And this is called A Rembrandt Drawing. When godlike, thoughtless, the statue sprung towards him in the garden, distant from oceans it commanded, hydraulically controlled, Descartes cleaved the brain from the mechanical, called the engine gristle, sinew, bone and mind, remote, empiric as a cloud, the impetus of thought sap through the neurologic tree. Or consciousness was tickled in a box by morsels of a demon's sense, confabulated self in an imagined world. Concurrent, but a Flanders span away, Rembrandt's fingers cogitated round his chalk, jostled by market scents and spills of mother's milk, bustled by millinery, beguiled by conspiracy tangled in curls, drawn to honey paper where the sanguine trail was trapped like pollen in an insect's hairs. And sure as a striker's toe that knows the angle and velocity to skirt the wall, made their mark. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jackie. I feel we should begin with the Oulipo question now, shall we? Should we ask about constraint? Because I think that is an interesting place to start.
Actually, I think this is one of my writing tips, if you don't already know, is actually that if you're finding it difficult to write something or you don't know what to write about, start with a constraint, because if you give people the opportunity to write anything, then... You know, if you do this on a workshop exercise, which I never would, you just said to people, like, oh, you can write anything you want, and you've got 20 minutes. 20 minutes later, they'd still be staring at the paper because they wouldn't know what to write about. If you say to them, you can write anything you want, but you can't use the word lemon, then suddenly that becomes a challenge, actually, because they desperately want to write about lemons at that point. I do an exercise. I don't do it much now. I used to do it a lot in schools. Writing about a toffee, which is, they had a real toffee, through all the five senses. So you write what you see, you make a noise it, and write what you hear, you unwrap it and write what you feel. They're always saying, are we going to be able to eat this? Well, obviously not yet. You smell it and write about the smell, what you smell, and then finally you eat it. But they were not allowed to use the word sweet. So they had to think about, like, they'd had, like, different vocabulary. So I think, and I also sometimes do an exercise actually writing exactly a story in exactly 100 words, where I give people a grid so they don't have to count. But, you know, again, that's a constraint that you've got to think about every word, whether it's used, whether you need it or not, and then you have to think about, can you put something else in to reach the total and this sort of thing. So I think constraints are really useful for creativity, but... Have you all heard of Oulipo? Okay, Oulipo is ouvrière de littérature potentielle, which is workshop for potential literature, basically. It still exists in France. It's been going in France for more than 50 years now. It's a group mainly of men, I have to say. I mean, I don't know what this says about me, but this is the thing that seems to appeal to men quite a lot. It's a group of French writers who basically have used constraints. Like, the one that's famous is Georges Perec, who wrote a novel without using the word, without using the letter E. So that's called a lipogram, which a lipogram on a certain letter means you can't use that letter. So he wrote a novel without the letter E, which has also been translated into English. Not using, I'd love to have done the translation. which is translated into English not using the letter E. That's the one that most people know about. They also did one which I don't entirely get, called N+1, which is you write a piece and then each noun, you look it up in the dictionary and then you count seven places on and you replace it with the word that comes seven places on in the dictionary.
I quite like the idea of that. That's quite good fun.
The problem with what comes out of Oulipo, I've got a book I really love, actually, which is an anthology of work from Oulipo, is that it's clever, but it's not really art. I mean, you think, oh, it's clever, they've done that, but it actually doesn't always make sense. You know, and you have to basically, in my view, take the raw material that you've created from that and then make something of it. You know, that's always the thing. The constraint generates the work, and generate some text. And you know, the main thing about writing is always to get something down on paper, because if you haven't got anything down on paper, you haven't got anything. If you've got something down on paper, you've got something you can use. And I think the constraint gets you to that stage of having something on paper, but then you've got to do the work of forming it and shaping it in some sort of way, which they don't tend to do with the lipo, because they just pat themselves on the head. aren't I clever for doing this? The constraints in here, I will tell you, the first one, look me up in Wikipedia, is a belle absente. These are all from Olipo, and that's their name for it, a belle absente in the feminine. And that means that in each line is like a little lipogram, actually, because each line has got a different letter removed from it. And this is a belle absente on Henrique. So the first line doesn't have an H in it. The second line doesn't have an E in it, which is why I had to say this portrait by Van Rijn rather than this portrait by Rembrandt. So you see, it's already making my mind work, because I can't use Rembrandt there. And the third doesn't have an N, and it goes on like that. So there is a version in the masculine, which is almost sounds almost the same, which is a belle absente, where you have to use every other letter. So if you take out an E, you've got to use the other 25 letters in the line.
Do you think the audience get that?
No.
If you're listening.
I don't really want them to, actually. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. That's why I always say, I'll tell you afterwards if you want to know, but nobody's ever asked me. I'll tell you afterwards what the constraints are if you want to know. But another form of constraint, actually, is a sestina. And in fact, in Olipo, they're quite interesting form. And I heard somebody read a sestina once, which has got like the same six words repeated in every verse, but in a different order. And she announced it was a sestina and said, and I want you to tell me afterwards what the words were. Now, I wouldn't do that, because I actually don't want people to think about what the words were. And in fact, I never listened to I was too busy trying to work out what the six words were, that I didn't actually listen to what she was reading. So I don't really particularly want people to know. But I'll tell you now anyway. Number two, quite simply, is an anagram. That's dear heart, this half that. And it's an anagram, but it's a bit of a cheat. It's an anagram on Rembrandt, Harmansohn, Van Rijn. But I couldn't use the Z and the J, so it's all the other letters apart from the Z and the J. The third one is a mesacrostic. You know a mesacrostic? You know an acrostic?
Yeah.
Meso means middle, so it runs down the middle rather than down. Mm-hmm. And this has got, if you can't really see it unless you look carefully and you know, but if you look carefully and you know, it has Henrique running down the middle of it. So there's the H in the... the E in leaves, or I can't even remember it myself. No, the H in challenge, the E in the C in contrast, and it goes all the way, the O in contrast, and it goes all the way down there. And the fourth one is a lipogram on Henrique's initials, H and S. So that's the one that begins with, I tend our place, look after Cornelia. So there's no H and S in that. So I was not able to say the name of Saskia, because I'd taken the S out.
And would you feel able to start with a constraint and, as you say, get some things to happen and then just ditch the whole thing and just write
then
it down?
Ditch the constraint, basically.
Yeah.
I think they're lots and lots of fun, and it does appeal to my... It appeals to the way I like to work, actually, but if you stick to the constraint, then... The constraint is the rest of the poem is a slave to the constraint. You've got to be prepared to use what you've got and move on. I mean, this is another aspect I think of when I teach poetry or any creative writing, actually, is that everything goes through several layers. You know, you start off with something and then it becomes something else, then it becomes something else, then it becomes something else, and in the second half, I'm going to read some poems from my pamphlet Ransom Notes, which are in here. And those were actually cut-up poems. They were around for years, actually, before they finally got published, because I worked on them on and off for a long time. And those started off with me cutting up out of my old notebooks fragments of things that I'd written that hadn't got anywhere, or bits of observations, and putting them in a bag with bits of newspaper articles and adverts and anything, you know, not literature, but anything that was, you know, any text. And then taking out these fragments randomly and putting them together until they did begin to make some sort of sense. and then using that and writing on from that again until it had got some sort of form to it. And they're called ransom notes because I stuck them down on the paper and they looked like a ransom note, basically. But but again, it was not... I mean, people do cut up poems where they just cut things up and rearrange them, but then they often... Maybe you want a kind of bit of, like, jagged edge between things, but to me, they don't... You can see the joins quite often. And I think, again, I'd always have to write... And some of them were written on so much that I can't actually remember what the original texts were that went into them. So sometimes I might just take two or three lines and start and work from there. But that is the kind of the principle where when I'm teaching creative writing, that's kind of the principle where, like, transformation and development is what I think is really important.
And but do you keep drafts of all your poems, or do you ever worry that about what was lost? It's a kind of courage in that, then, because if you've lost, what was the original impulse of, you know, the poem? When do you know if it's travelling too far, or do you have to stop somehow?
I mean, I would redraw forever, and this is the same when I'm writing fiction. I'm writing novels at the moment, so I've got one that's more or less ready to, which I think I'm going to self-publish, and it's more or less ready to go. But actually, I'm really reluctant to let it go because I've redrafted it over and over again, and I'm still kind of sometimes thinking, well, I should have, even like one tiny little scene, like, oh, I should have said so and so differently and things like that. And it doesn't really matter, I don't think. At the end of the day, nobody's going to know that you could have said it differently. But I don't keep old drafts, but I know, because I've done it occasionally just as a kind of an exercise thing to show people how many drafts went into something, but I don't particularly, I just trust that where I am is where I want to be.
That's interesting, especially when you return to poems that have been published before and much later. Did you change things that were in earlier pamphlets?
A very little amount. Some of the really early ones I changed a little bit, but mostly not. Mostly they're as they were.
They were as they were. So there's definitely a point when you do.
I think you have to accept. I mean, I remember having a discussion with this once with somebody who was actually a visual artist, but was sort of talking to me about at what point do you think a thing is finished? And I said, actually, I think when a thing is published, then you can't change it further. The writer can't change it further. Though I suppose you can actually change it again for another edition. But I think once it's published, you become part of the readership like everybody else, and you kind of respond to it as a reader rather than as a writer. And so generally, I think when things are published, I'd be reluctant to change things a lot once they've been published. But I'd say some of the very early ones, I thought, I could, you know, change, make that sound a little bit more... a bit smoother or something like that. But I didn't change very much at all.
That's interesting. And I wanted to ask you, unless anybody else wants to jump in at this point, as we're talking a lot about process and how the poet, then, if that's of interest. But I did also want to make time to explore this writing in response to images, because I find that really interesting. I don't know. And how... you begin that. I mean, I would be interested to know, actually, even just do you write in front of the picture, and how do you think about the reader and the relationships that are existing? It's quite complex, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, ekphrasis is very complicated. It's very hard to do well, actually, and because I've spent such a lot of time, before I actually was at the Barber, I'd had residencies in other places where I've written in response to it. I've got A-level art as well, and I would actually have liked to have done... I would like my degree to have been in art history, but my parents thought art was like you were never going to earn your living through art, basically, so be an English teacher. That's what I would like to have done. So I've always been really interested in art history, and so I'm always grateful to have the opportunity to write, and I liked what I find out about the art as well. I'm always in the process of writing it. The problem with writing about paintings or sculpture or visual art is that there's no reason nowadays to describe a painting for people, because they say it's got the names of the paintings here. You can look them up, and I put the link to the Barber website in there. You can look these up and see what they look like. So there's no point in me describing what the painting looks like, because you can see it. There was a time, you know, like before the middle of the 19th century, but even probably then for some people, well, the only thing people knew about paintings was what they read, was the descriptions they read of them. So they didn't, you know, they had to imagine them, they didn't see them. Right up until Well, I mean, the photograph room in the Barbara is an interesting example of this, actually, because the photographs, the Barbara has got photographs in black and white of artworks from all around the world that are, that students used to study. A lot of places actually have these, and they've actually got rid of them, but the Barbara's kept this. And that's the room where we do our, where I do my workshops, and it smells of old photographs. It's an amazing room. We sometimes get them down for the workshops to look at. But nowadays, nobody needs to do that because art history students can just go and look them up on the internet and they're there in colour, they're not in black and white. But, you know, right up to the end, to quite late in the 20th century, not everything was available to be seen. And so sometimes people still did need descriptions. But nowadays, nobody needs a description of a painting. So if you're going to write about a painting, the one thing you don't want to do is write about exactly what it looks like, you know, like here is a woman with blonde hair sitting in a chair looking through a window, because you can find it. So you've got to start off with the idea that you're going to produce something else, basically, and your response is going to be different. The Nina Lopez one, the one of the Renoir portrait, the portrait of a young woman, and another one that's in here as well, which is a response to a Magritte called The Flavour of Tears, came from an exhibition, a temporary exhibition, which only had three works in it, actually, on three walls in the gallery, that had music, electronic music, composed by students from Birmingham University, and some of them they'd competed, and these three had been chosen, and you could sit in front of the painting and listen to this electronic music. And the Renoir one definitely came out of... I mean, I sat there over and over again, actually, and listened to it over and over again until I started to see kind of the picture began to move and things like this. And some of the things in the poem were actually some of the sounds I heard. I mean, there's things like violin practice and things like that. They were things I heard in the music. So it wasn't just, it was something, it was another dimension to it. I always say, obviously when I'm doing workshops at the Barbara, a lot of what people are doing is writing about paintings, is that what you're aiming to do really is to create a piece of art yourself, which is verbal art, but it's a piece of art which could stand with that piece, that painting, but it's not the same as the painting. You know, it's giving people... You know, the way in which poetry, good poetry, is going to make you see things differently. Mm. Then good poetry about a work of art is going to make you see that work of art differently and somehow see yourself differently as a result. So it's very hard, though. It's a very hard thing to do, I think.
Yes, yes. I was going to say, actually, that the sense of a poem as a painterly object or a physical object is really strong in the poems. And the way you use words, it's loads of colour. For anyone who loves colour, this is a collection just so rich in colour, it's lovely, but it's also a kind of density of language too, and that...
Yes, because paintings do tend to be quite complex, actually. Even the ones that are very... I mean, even like a Rothko, has got the texture, you know, Rothko, which is just two planes of colour, has got the texture of the brush strokes and the way the edges meet. There's a kind of randomness where the edges meet and things like that. And so paintings are generally quite complex. So just saying, here's a painting of a girl looking out of a window, and it reminds me of when I sat in my living room looking out, you know, it's not doing the painting justice. I think you've got to get that level, so that you've got what comes through when you read it. When you read it, first of all, it's like when you first look at the painting and see like this, the surface area of it, but then the more you read it, you go into the depths like you do as you look into the depths of a painting. And I like paintings, actually, that have areas of shiny dark on them where you see yourself. I love paintings where you see yourself, because actually, it's not in this, but I have in the past written about a whole sequence of contemporary paintings where I just looked at myself in each of them and wrote about sort of where how I my own relation to what I saw. I really like seeing myself in a painting and then writing somehow about how I am within it.
I just like to painting with a glass frame or a painting with a strong varnish.
Anything will happen. I mean, most paintings now have got glass frames, but they're actually not that shiny because they've got like glass that doesn't reflect so much. But it's not as easy to do now as it used to be.
I think Bacon insisted he had non-museum glass in it for exactly that reason, so that you look at his ghastly paintings and you've got your your
You've
got your reflection pack.
Yeah, so you get some, even if they're ghastly paint, you get some of which is yourself in the. So I do like that. I like to think about myself in relation to what's what to what I'm writing, to what's in the picture. Yeah,
and that came across in the Rembrandt poem about his common law wife, that she became quite a contemporary character. Obviously the opening does that, and then you mentioned the idea of wishing to be her friend.
Oh yeah,
and that's lovely, that sense that poetry can make things bring that feeling in.
That's an exercise we do, actually. I mean, these are exercises you could use. I can't remember all the categories, but an exercise I've done sometimes when we've been writing about characters in art is I always have an opening exercise that sends people around the gallery to look for something, so they actually get in touch with the gallery before. I mean, they can go up to the galleries again during the course of the workshop, but the first thing they do is actually go and see the art. And so I give them something to find. And one is for character, is finding, it's five people, I can't remember the one, but one is find the person who you would like to be your friend. So of all the images in the gallery, who of these would you like to be friends? And then the other one is the person you would cross over the road to avoid. A person who you think you could teach you something. I can't remember them all, but there's five of them, and then we discuss, when we get together, we discuss like why we like these people and why we chose these people.
Mm.
Have you ever thought about picking up a paintbrush after writing a poem?
Well, I can paint. It's a strange thing. I can paint, and actually, but I don't paint. The first year I was at the Barber, I went to a group. I went to lots of things actually that were going on, and I went to a group of people who were mental health people had mental health issues, like survival art group. And I did a painting. They were painting, so I started doing a painting. And I went, and after that, I did actually do a painting at home, which I've still got, and I've not done anything. And I thought, oh, I could start painting, but actually, I never wanted. I can draw as well, but I don't draw because I find it very, very hard, which I don't with writing, to make a mark on a paper, to make a mark of to start a drawing, or to make a mark of paint on a canvas, because it's like irrevocable, you know, and so I'm a very timid visual artist.
You can give back.
Yeah, I know. I think a lot of people actually, it's, a lot of people are scared to make a mark on the paper to write at it, so I kind of understand from that point of view. And again, you say you can cross it out, you can, but they're scared to start. Mm. And I think I'm like that with visual art. So I make things, actually. I make jewellery and I make lots of things, actually. But I don't actually want to be a painter, I don't think, really.
Mm. I was curious to talk a little bit about meaning and the tensions between how you what you think about the way that people seek meanings in poems or narratives or try and find. Do you think that, I mean, because obviously that's something, is that something hard to control, so that you tend to not worry about it at all?
I'm happy if people find a meaning in a poem which I didn't know was there. There's a poem by Denise Levertov which is called The Secret, which I'm not sure that actually what the context is, but I always imagine that she's done a school visit to a high school or something, because it's like teenage girls. But afterwards, after she's spoken, some teenage girls come up to her and kind of like tell her they know the secret of the poem, and they're really excited, and it's not what she thought, but she's really pleased because they found something there. And that's, I always think that would be my favourite thing ever to happen, quite honestly, somebody found something. And it means such a lot to them, you know, but it's not what she intended in the first place. So I think that's fine, because everybody brings to what they read something of themselves, and you can't predict that.
Yeah.
And so therefore, I wouldn't want to control that. I don't like it when people present you one of their poems and say, it's about, you know, because it's about what's on the page, you know, like it's a, you know, people give you a poem about a pool in woodland and say, it's about my father's death. Well, it's not, it's about a pool in the woodland, you know, but you're kind of, you're being evasive if you're saying that it's about something else. And the reader, if there's no clues for the reader that it's about something you've been through, or then they're going to just take what's there on the page. That's all the reader can do, is take what's there on the page and think, this is a brilliant description of this pool in woodland. I absolutely, you know, it's making me feel this and making me feel that. And yet the poet could feel they'd failed because the reader hasn't realised, you know, that it's about mourning or it's about resentment or something like that. So I think, well, another thing actually is that once a poem's gone, and I know that poems don't reach a massive audience, but you know, a pamphlet might reach 100 or so people. You're not going to control everything those 100 or so people are going to get out of that poem. So somewhere, somebody is getting something out of your poem that you didn't think was in it. And that's fine by me, I think.
So how do you pick a title?
I hate picking titles. Dreadful at times. I'm quite good at picking titles for other people, actually. Some of the titles of some of our pamphlets have been mine. And sometimes I've suggested to some authors, you know, that you could call it so this, and they've gone along with that. But I'm rubbish at picking a title myself, actually. Which is why quite often I'll avoid having a title.
Can I just explore a bit the difference between somebody reading your poetry and you, for example, reading your poetry, or someone else interpreting your poetry? Because you will then have... You could give a definitive meaning by the way that you stress, where you pause. Yeah, I mean, as actors, we always are doing that, changing the text.
I think that's true, actually. But I do change how I read poems. The Apollinaire one, Merveille de la Guerre, because Apollinaire writes in such an idiosyncratic sort of way, when I first used to read it, I used to deliberately not read with the line breaks. Because it's written so that the sense can be different depending on way. So I used to deliberately not read that. And George Tooley, who I don't think he's a poet who I knew quite well at one time, but I think he's still at Warwick University. And Simon Turner used to do a podcast called Gists and Pithes, which was great actually. And he did it was a blog, but on this occasion it was a podcast. He did a podcast about war poetry, and he said, could he use my Merveille de la Guerre in it. And hearing him read it, he read it with the line breaks, and it was very, very different from the way I read it. And in fact, you know, you could have got two different interpretations, right? But then somebody else, they could read it, you know, there's no punctuation in it, so somebody else could read it differently from either of us and still get something else out of it. But I think, yeah, actually, if you hear, it's one of the reasons why I like hearing poets read, actually, because it does kind of sometimes clarify, or it gives me a different spin on things from the way I thought if I know the poems, that they're saying something different from what I maybe thought. But I think still what the reader gets out of it is valid.
Oh, yeah, I mean, I think it's important. I'm just thinking how different it is. Because, you know, as an actor with a poem or a text, whatever your text you're working with, you can actually see, oh, I've changed that emphasis. Then, and I'm learning that, you know, my second night in performance, my third night in performance, my 55th performance. And you can change that.
Yeah.
But what I think what you were saying earlier is that, you know, often for the reader will have different interpretations, but I could skew, if you like, the response. And I'm just thinking that in the written poetry, you have got lots of responses, the way that person is reading that poem in their own head. But when you present that poem, so I think also what I'm thinking is that when you read it, if I listen to you reading, then I go and read your poem,
and you,
I may, you know, read it because I've heard you and the emphasis that you put on it with your interpretation,
and then you hear it the way the person's written, so it does sort of affect you. But as I say I might read it lots of different ways, and so you might hear me read it another time. I would read it completely differently, and so therefore It would be how I felt it at that time. Really.
So you're finding.
I think as I said earlier, I think once a work's published, the author of it becomes a reader the same as everybody else, and it's then for them to find more the meanings in it that other people would find, and a range of meanings in it. Because otherwise, if it only ever means one thing to you as a writer, then it is quite sort of static and quite, I'd say dead, but you know, it's not dynamic. Whereas you kind of want that dynamism. You want it to. There's an example. The very last poem I'm going to read actually is 18 years old, and that kind of means something different to me now from what it did at the time I wrote it. But it's still got the core of what it meant at the time. I'll explain when I come to read it.
Well, that sounds lovely. Well, that's a good cue to, I think, hear Jackie read.
Okay, my second lot.
Yes, please.
I will stand up again. I've got quite comfortable sitting there. I've got to go to my iPad for this one. I haven't been writing much new poetry. It's interesting, actually. I saw Angela France last week reading at Deborah Alma's launch, reading from her collection The Hill, which I think is a brilliant collection. I really love to hear Angela France read, actually. And she was saying that collection had kind of hadn't lost the grip of that collection on her. It's still got its hold on her, and so therefore she's finding it quite hard to write other poetry. I'm writing fiction, and so therefore, in a way, when I'm writing fiction, I find it quite hard to write poetry, but I'm also finding it quite hard to, almost to think about what to write since Blink came out. But this is new, and I thought I should read it here, because it kind of refers to, it's kind of inspired by the area around here. This is another art history poem, actually. It's another one from, this is from Birmingham Museum and Art Gallery. And this painting has got the longest title of any painting I've ever heard. It's called Never Morning Water Evening, But Some Heart Did Break by Walter Langley. It's a kind of Pre-Raphaelite-ish. And it's two fisherwomen, an older woman comforting a young woman in the evening, basically. You can guess, you know, that she's been through a tragedy of some sort. Now, I used to work on a project that was run by the Courtyard Hereford, and other places as well, particularly the Courtyard Hereford, where a group of us who are poets worked in care homes, doing placements in care homes, working with people in care homes and taking their words with very little alteration and turning them into poems, basically, with none of our own words and actually just sort of reshaping them in a sort of way. And one of the pictures, we used to use pictures with groups of them for them to talk about. And one of the pictures I used actually was that picture. I had a set of that picture, and I did actually use it very near to here at a care home in Eastmer. And so this scene that came out I thought of when I saw the painting, actually happened very near to here. So this is called Walter Langley in the Care Home. In the shadow of the Malverns, postcards handed round, and one asks, where is this? And another, where are we? And talks about her husband's funeral. Remember me when I've gone. One wakes, remembers herring girls who came to gut the catch were gone by Christmas, dozes back. Some turn them over, never morning wore a hat one last, I hated that, to evening, but some heart did break. She knows it long ago from school. Memoriam, she thinks. Another speaks of a proposal. How she saw him in the wartime street and told her mother he would be her husband. Remember, I've gone. Her first fiancé, lost at sea. And I'll go on to a couple of places that are closer to me, actually. My poetry school group meets in Digbeth, near Birmingham city centre. We used to meet at the Warehouse Cafe in Digbeth, which is quite a nice vegetarian cafe, but quite a noisy room we worked in. And they asked us all to give them a poem, and this was mine, and this is called Digbeth River. What strikes you in these folded lanes is the dryness of a place so designated water. Nothing to do with shovels. Pools beside the dike. Beth, an early Brummy joke that this was not the spot where Romans bathed, but could have been. Floodgates promising a fertile plain. The course that soused the tanneries and mills. The river's path reduced a thimbleful. The wrong juice when the rain falls, when the current pumps from Wales. And how we walk the towpath of its structured wings behind the bow of the great cargo store found wormwood, and the man who told us jettison bananas grew with tea plants on the bank. Then we leaned over, watched a dribble of the ray spat out of stone and brick and locks. made our way back up Dusty River Street. I like to think of that as my Roy Fisher poem. And this one I like to think of as my Geoffrey Hill poem. This is in Kings Norton, which is in the southwest of Birmingham, which you go through on the train from Ledbury to university, but it doesn't stop there. Which was the site of an Anglo-Saxon settlement, and there is woodland there which belonged to Offa. And this was basically just a guided walk that I went on round there. This is called Offa in Kings Norton. Leaving the morning glory and the bridge where James has scrawled his love for Liz, Offa by proxy strides the bounds of gifted woodland, watermarked by lindens in the brook. At all points he saw the spire before it was there, a ganglion of rivulets and ancient tracks signposted by a shudder in the air. We taste for him the darkening blackberries he misses this year, distracted by Franks or northern lords, fording the Alps before the snow, skulking in foreign foothills, while we toast his absence with calcium carbonate and drifts, a wavering trade, soapy outside the shifting factory. Spare him the curse of Indian balsam straight from hell, telling the story of perhaps a kingfisher. My friend was leading the walk, and actually somebody said, what's that? And she said, it's Indian balsam straight from hell! So I thought, because she had it in her garden, basically. Okay, these are three. I mentioned the ransom notes, so I don't need to explain these I don't need to explain how I did these, I've already told you that. But these are three ransom notes that I put in here that were in the pamphlet that I did with V Press. I'll just read them through. The meaning really is up for grabs in these, I have to say. Glacier. 3 weeks of snow away from home, jam on the windows, ironing smell of tyres, when ice incises inside, outside. What's there to say? Inside this glacier of art, of how the wolverine dived back into the sea and felt his limbs retract into a dolphin. Someone scrambling a bag and sting-faced children scatters broken crisps that scrape in tracks pedestrian. Until the reds go off. What's there to say? And I call this phlogiston, but on QI they always say phlogiston. I'm sticking with phlogiston. But light was not his field. Dirtier in busy doors and tightly woven doorways, shades of its refraction trimmed and skimmed dishevelled ladies. His brain kept flaming spills alive in bell jars. Birds fell dead out of the sky, his fantasy revelling at length in patterns of great earthquakes. The certain stars showed smiles of loosened hair, wicking away all terrible appearances and unforeseen. In time, he went for phlogiston, and weeping, said within himself the first breath of a word. And this is called Bicyclist. It's all got difficult to pronounce titles. The titles were actually just a random word out of the poem. It wasn't that random, it was a word I liked out of the poem. When clocks retract in this purloined hour in altered forms of words, we make a film about, invisible twice over, a hidden Muslim on a bicycle. You conjure worlds inside this room that play together to infinity, where unconsidered children anticipate reunion. Trains are running consequentially in places we may never touch. If that's not how it is, you say, our unborn intentions never anywhere but here. Our only chance is le bicycliste argilien, and in fake time, this conversation. And I'll finish with three poems about women. The first two I've put together, actually, because I kind of think they weren't written together in any sort of way at all, but I sort of think that maybe the woman in them is the same person, or it's the thoughts and of how one person sees herself. I don't know, but they seem to go together. The first one is called At the Death Cafe, and I have to say that, you know, trigger warning, At the Death Cafe, that it's about death. I wrote this actually after a workshop at Birmingham Literature Festival 2 or 3 years ago, They sometimes run overnight workshops, so you go at about 11 o'clock and you write all through the night, and you leave at 6 o'clock in the morning. And this was at the Coffin Works in Birmingham. This was an all-night workshop at the Coffin Works in Birmingham. Coffin Works is a little bit of a letdown, actually, because they didn't make coffins. They made coffin furniture, which is like handles and RIP plates and shrouds and that. But they had got a display of fanciful coffins as well, so because people had obviously turned up thinking they wanted to see the coffins, and there weren't any. And also, it was the first time I'd heard about the Death Cafe, because they had one there, so I was interested in that as well. So I got this out of that workshop at the Death Cafe. After the support group, InReach, daycare, church, it's not what you expect of the Death Cafe. No one's skeletal or sharing test results. All their talk washed over by green tea and swallowed down with carrot cake. She's got used to dairy-free, no gluten. While they fondled tinny RIPs and polyester swatches out of shrouds. Pros of burial in wooden eggs contorted back into a fetus, I ask you. Forests set aside for that ungodly purpose. Cons of flat-packed coffins. Jokes about Allen keys she doesn't care to understand. It's too much like the documentary she watches when there isn't wildlife on the other side. Days of the Dead and how some filthy devils get put straight into the ground. Who draws curtains now, she wants to say. Or wears a hat to take off when a hearse crawls by. Donations, not carnations, pressed up against the window in the shape of mother. And this nonsense about passing, but not away. Safely on the sideboard, propped against the photo of her mum and dad, typed, to whom it may concern, with secretarial precision, her funeral agenda. Dimensions of the space remaining in the family plot. Where to find that outfit she's preserved. Who gets what, blanked out and reinstated. The dog, in case it pines, to be destroyed. That's the real trigger warning, but if I tell you what's coming up, that is actually, I know you shouldn't say it was, that's true, you shouldn't say I wrote that in the paper because it's true. It's actually true. Somebody did say to me, actually, that they were thinking of writing in their will that they wanted their dog to be taken to be put down because it would pine without them being there, which I just thought was a massive narcissism to write. Like, you know, like...
No, it's
not
sooty.
Yes. And this one was, as I say, it could be the same woman, I don't know, but it's another one about a woman. This is from a project called Penning Perfumes, which Claire Trevian ran. And the poets involved received a file of perfume, but no identification about what it was. And we had to write something. And then there was an event. There were several around the country, and I was at the Birmingham one. There was an event where we read this, and then the audience were given like swatches of the smell, I think you call them swatches of the perfume to smell while we were reading. Mine was Infusion of Iris by Guerlain, and I was really pleased actually that I got that it was iris, because the proof is that it's mentioned in the poem. I definitely got it was a blue smell, and that it was iris. So I was more excited about it than the poem actually. I've got the scent right. This is called Spilt. Oh, I spilt some in my handbag. So the stimulus for writing this was the idea of somebody spilling some of this perfume, which I thought smelled quite old-fashioned, an old-fashioned handbag. The whispered crash of midnight glass of Cobalt Boulevard she'll never know. The slow, slow, quick flow through satin lining flayed to ostrich skin. She clutches, handles, vanillin, coumarin. A dash of plumped-up violets, their sweet synthetic breath more true than real, than wilted clumps pinned to her fur. Quintessence of mysotis, iris, tincture of wisteria, abscond. The pillow scent of unbrushed hair in cool hotels, it wells in seams, swells inside pockets, douses ticket docks, elicits stubs of silvery romance, anoints a 10-bob note with aldehyde, blurs her compact face, dyes hanky lace azure, turns a novelette to mush. No use for it. The rigid mouth unclasped each time she needs to pay, coppers for the powder room, the bus, betrays what dwells in dreams beyond the pulse. She sops it up with rag and cotton wool, picks out flakes of shattered flask, masks fragrance with cologne like something soiled. tells herself it's no more than a bag, and stashes it inside a drawer where sometimes mending, making do her daily chores, rummaging for stocking thread, she gasps, imbibes a wisp of sapphire, royal, ultramarine, the battered glow of rain-washed pavements leading to forgotten dance halls, fading fall of notes on bathroom floors, good nights left unsaid, discarded shoes and kisses trailing her to sleep, perfume more deep, more truly blue, chillier now than she recalls. And I'll end with the 18-year-old poem. I know this poem is 18 years old because I wrote it when my daughter was 12 and she's now 30. So the collection is dedicated to Claudia, like my first pamphlet was dedicated to her. And this was in my first pamphlet. When I was really seriously first writing poetry, she did used to come with me to readings and things like that, and I did write a sort of sequence of poems about her, of which two are now in here. And this is what I was saying about like seeing something differently now. How I see it differently now, in a way, this is actually reinforces what I knew at the time, which is that she is one of the most fearless people I've ever known, right back to when she was a baby. So this is when I was writing this when she was 12, but I was looking back to when she was a baby. Like the signs of fearlessness I'd seen then, which I saw in her when she was 12, and she is even now just the same. I mean, she's a massive traveller all over the world, and she just really is somebody I admire hugely. But I admired her in the same way when she was a baby, and so this is called Mother's Sonnet. Reading Plath beside your cot while geese flew over, I often wished you were a puppy. Then I would have known not to listen for your insect breath, not to rouse your sleeping to confirm your life, nor drag you on a lead. Would not have felt you in my face and wrists, save nails and hair and teeth the fairy left. Not have been scared to show my joy to Chinese gods and jealous ghosts. But you did not fear the looming dog, the duck that chased your yellow coat, embrace the little goat that towered above the pushchair. Listening to Elgar on the cello, I slid my fingers down the bars, skyhooks when your hind legs snapped you vertical, and knew your life was never mine to lose. Thank you.